What was your exact role at UN?
I was Assistant Secretary General.
Yes,
at the UN, and then I was Deputy Executive Director of UN Women.
Emma Watson campaign. Were you like directly a part of that?
Yes.
Minority of women who equate feminism with hating men, that has nothing to do with any patriarchal message at all. It is simply a vicious attack against the idea of being a man.
Right. Women and girls are undervalued, devalued. Yatra Naryastu Pujyante Ramante Tatra Devata. That is the belief that we have. And yet, we treat them as second-class citizens. And as I say in my book, the fifth caste.
This is a difficult question because it's very hard to sort of give a book recommendation list or five books that you would recommend people read. What is up, my friends? Welcome to another episode of Those Casts. My name is Vinamra Kasana. Don't forget to subscribe because we release new episodes every Tuesday and Friday at 12 p.m. Indian Standard Time. Today's guest is Lakshmi Murudeshwar Puri. She is the former Assistant Secretary General at the UN. She was also the ambassador from India to Hungary. She has also served as an IFS officer in multiple countries, including Pakistan, Japan, Sri Lanka, and many, many, many more. Her career spans not only politics, her career spans not only diplomacy, but also international peacekeeping. And now, she has recently come out with a fiction book which paints the independence struggle that Indians went through to get their freedom from the British. She does it through stories, she does it through poetry, she does it through stories she learned from her mother and father and all others, and paints a beautiful picture of the independence that has sadly been lost, and beautifully bridges the gap between the independence struggle and the kind of angst and the ambition that young Indians feel today. This was certainly a challenging conversation because we also spoke about modern feminism and had a little bit of a debate about that. I think you will like this. I'm from a different generation. She's from a different generation. And it's unlikely you will see this kind of a conversation anywhere else in the Indian content landscape. Without further ado, this excellent conversation with Lakshmi Murudeshwar Puri begins in 3, 2, 1. I want to ask you, what is it like? I mean, because there are several civilians, normal people watching this who will never have a career in the IFS or the UN. How is it different from civilian life beyond, I guess, the obvious, living in an embassy and like having people in your staff and basically representing India? How is it different from civilian life?
For one, you have to be prepared to move around.
At all times?
Well, after every 2-3 years.
Okay.
In a different country, coming back also. We were just counting the other day how many times we have moved house. And we counted 23 times.
Wow.
So.
And none of you are from the army.
Huh?
And none of you are from the army.
So, yes. Maybe it's something similar to some of these services where you have to move around a lot. But this is to foreign countries. So that is one.
So you've changed countries 23 times.
Well, let us say residences.
Okay.
Sometimes even within a country, we had to change. So that's fine. So that is one, that you have to be ready to up your anchor and then move to another country or another place. So that is one. The other is cultural adaptability.
Hmm.
So you have to be able to adapt to a new country, new situation very quickly. And, you know, there's one definition of intelligence is how adaptable you are to a new situation, to a new interlocutor whom you're negotiating with from a different field. You know, today our diplomats are required to negotiate on science and technology, on space, on investment, foreign direct investment, on trade. So how adaptable you are intellectually as well.
How do you become adaptable like that? Do you read a few books? Like, for example, you go to a new country. Do you buy 100 ways to speak Spanish better, like small books like that?
Language is a very important part of adaptability. But also, as you rightly said, you seek to immerse yourself in the local culture and local, meet local people, not remain in your diplomatic enclave, you know, and get to understand their ethos, what stirs them, you know, what moves them.
Hmm.
So these are some of the things. Yes, and of course, the beginning always is to read about, read the history. I'm a history student, so I always begin with reading about the history of a people and a country. And then from there, you also identify in a very modern way, as you people would do today, what ticks and what, you know, ticks them off.
What not to do with them.
What not to do with them, what to do with them,
yeah.
How to, you know, reach their hearts and minds. So I think that is certainly the whole essence of adaptability.
I think I recently went to Spain for a long trip. And instead of reading tourist guidebooks, I decided to pick up a book called The New Spaniards, which was a history of Spain contextualized to the present moment.
Voila.
And I got through 57% of the book. But by the time I got there, I had an appreciation for what these people had been through.
Mm.
So I would not, sometimes I would falter, but I would still try to see them as a people and not as flamenco guitars and
yes.
tapas,
yes.
you know, like the
words
we use.
Stereotypes or the emblematic
Correct.
Elements only. Yes.
Yeah.
You go beneath that.
So I think the historical study of any place is important, but you know, let's switch from there to becoming an ambassador. Okay, I'm not sure, like, we often hear about like the big countries, we hear about India-China relations, we hear about India-US relations, India-Russia relations, but a country like Hungary, which is essentially in Central Europe, what do you do as an ambassador there? Do you just sort of maintain peace? Do you open bilateral agreements, if at all, with them? Do you maybe like open cultural programs? Because what does an ambassador do in a country where it's not the most strategically significant relationship?
Absolutely.
From a geopolitical
Absolutely.
Standpoint.
Absolutely. So that's a very good question, because that's the question I asked myself. It was my first ambassadorship. And I was wanting to make a big difference in, as you said, a country which is a small country of 10 million people in the heart, literally the heart of Europe, okay? And one that was poised to join the European Union at that time. And so when I... went there, someone, I told someone, let me look at it positively, that the level of our trade, investment, technology, interaction was quite low, and our cultural, the potential for cultural exchange was tremendous. There was tremendous interest in Hindi and Indology.
Really?
Yes.
In Hungary?
Yes, in Hungary. We had great Indologists and Hindi scholars in Hungary. So I said, I'm going to really swell this cultural relationship to a level which it has never been, but also building something ground up is so exciting, and you can show the difference. You know, when you go into a relationship like India-UK, my husband at that time went to London as Deputy High Commissioner at the same time. And so it was a full-blown historical relationship, full-blown in, trade and investment and political relationship. So whatever differences they made was not so visible.
Mm.
Whereas what I was able to do in terms of making a difference in that relationship. As I mentioned, the TCS investment. And I also was trying to bring in others. And for the and the growing the Indian community there, for example. You know, that with it was a very small Indian community. And then this TCS investment meant many more coming in, other companies getting interested, and using this very strategic country as a base for Europe.
Hmm.
So you see, it's like a jumping point,
right?
You know? So that is how, you know, the other aspect which was fascinating was that Hungary is very strong on science and technology.
Okay.
Yes, and in many areas. In fact, they have, a small country like that has something like 10, you know, Nobel Prize winners in mostly in science and technology.
Which is extremely rare.
Yes. Yes.
Yeah.
Yes. So that relationship I sought to connect our scientific establishment with theirs. And then sports. They are, again, a country like that used to win 10 Olympic gold medals, you know. So I said, why can't we use some of their coaches? So I tied up about swimming. I tied up about some of the other sports connections that could be made between their institutions, their coaches, and ours. So, you know, these are the ways in which you try and bring value to an ambassadorship and change the relationship. And as you rightly put, yes, it was not strategically important then, but then it became, even whilst I was there, it became a member of the European Union.
Interesting. And how was, if at all, how were you able to manage your relationship with Mr. Puri, because he was posted elsewhere? And were you guys married at that time or no?
Sorry?
How were you able to manage your life with your husband posted elsewhere, because he was also a member of the IFS?
Yes.
How do you make that happen? Because you're both posted in different countries, I'm assuming.
So at that time, yes, we were posted in different countries. But for a large part of our careers, we managed to be posted together. And for some 6-7 years, we remained in India, you know, after we became eligible to become ambassadors. And mm-hmm. That's why I have only one ambassadorship to my credit. Because we chose to remain in India for 6 years, 6-7 years, before we went on our first ambassadorships. So, yes, we tried to be, and I think the ministry was great, and they are very good in keeping tandem couples in the same missions.
Tandem couples?
They are called tandem couples.
Okay.
That if you're two foreign service officers married to each other, are called tandem couples.
Okay. Yeah.
So they have been very good. And it's also a very good sign of being women friendly, you know, and gender responsive.
I see. I
mean, feminist foreign policy, you know what I call the feminist foreign policy.
That's
part
cool.
of that. So institutionally to be responsive to the needs of women officers.
Because I would assume that mostly people are separated by duty and they have to only meet in transit at an airport somewhere and just...
Yes, that we have done. We have done when he went to Brazil, when and I was in Geneva, when he was in London, I was in Budapest. So there have been times when we have been separated.
Do you miss all the global traveling? Or do you prefer to stay in Delhi?
I have visited more than I was just counting. The other day, I was applying for a US visa.
Mm-hmm.
And they ask you to put down all the places you've visited in your life. So I said, if I start listing, it would be. And then I started counting in my mind. And I said, I've been to more than 76 countries
wow.
in the world in my different incarnations. 15 years with the UN. I was with UN Conference on Trade and Development. And then 7 years with UN Women, and before that with the Office of the High Representative for Least Developed Countries and Small Island Developing States. So I visited all continents, and I visited also small island developing states, some of them. So it's been a wonderful, you know, discovery of the world.
Yeah, I have a travel blogger friend. He pretty much travels to 2 countries in a week, more or less.
Okay.
He's my age. He's only done 81, but he's sort of done it in a very like touch and go way.
Okay.
Must be crazy. 76 countries.
Countries at least. I'm sure more, but I've covered almost every continent and
So your biases and like prejudices must fall to the wayside when you're traveling so much, because all you have is you have to engage with the outside world. You can't carry your...
You know, being an Indian helps.
Because really?
Yes, because you have a universalist vision of the world. You know, I think when we were chatting earlier, I talked about Vasudhaiva Kutumbakam.
Mm-hmm.
And also spiritually, you know, that we believe in the oneness of humanity and that everyone, you know, is divine. So that kind of that spirit that you carry with you really helps you to embrace everything that looks alien externally, but is so, you know, so that you can relate to very quickly.
Yeah, I've definitely seen that. Indians are usually nice when they're going abroad. Although I found that most people have a very weird and probably misjudged idea that, oh, if we go outside, we will be attacks of racism, which, you know, generally never happens. But there's a kind of phobia spreading on the internet about racist attacks against Indians. I don't know. I've never experienced it, but this is a common trend. Anyway, we're going to move on from here. Obviously, since we're talking about Indians, we have to talk about your book, Swallowing the Sun.
Yeah.
And you can now show it to the camera.
So here it is.
Yeah. And you've got those nice little post-it notes on it.
Post-it notes on it, just in case we read something from.
Okay, wonderful. So, this is the context for the book. It's a story about your mother and father, and tied into a way so that it's fictionalized and covers important events and themes around India's fight for independence. Before we started actually filming, I was talking about how right now, as an Indian, I feel sort of in the middle, feel sometimes disgruntled. I care about the country, but I'm detached from that fervor that our ancestors who fought for the freedom of this country felt, right? It's been too long. There's not enough talks. In fact, I would even say when Americans and Britishers talk about their ancestors and their forefathers and foremothers, they can easily point to the two world wars. Right, and instantly they're given respect. But I don't see enough stories about Indian independence and people from that era getting the same respect. With that context, what compelled you to not only one, write this book, second, to bring this out now? Because one would say, fine, we got independence in 1947, great, someone worked for it, why care about it now?
But you've said it when you asked that first question, that the young people today are so removed in time and space, intellectual space, emotional space, from our fight for freedom and struggle for freedom, that they don't even think about it, or they don't value that freedom that we have today, or mm-hmm. value the fact that where India has arrived today as an independent country. And also, 75 years since we achieved independence. So it means something. It's a platinum jubilee. So this is something, therefore, which my book tries to stir up the memories of that and the soul of that. That impelled young people at that time, sometimes to sacrifice their homes, sacrifice their lives, sacrifice their education, and just be passionate about freeing India from the bondage that she was shackled by. So that is something that I wanted to bring and to remind young people. But equally, I refer to your other sentiment that young people today must feel, and at this 75, India at 75 point, and you know, there is this envisioning of an Amrit Kaal, mm-hmm. the age in a way of immortality, but also an age which is going to lead us at 100, India at 100 years from independence, to being a developed country in terms of prosperity, everyone being prosperous, no poverty, our being able to give a high standard of living to everyone, but also being equally spiritually involved, evolved, and culturally evolved. And culturally as enriched as we are by our legacy destined to be. So it is that destiny of greatness that we are poised at. And I want the young people to read this book to get an idea of what it was to be a young man or woman. And at that time, the women who were coming up were getting educated, or even women who were not, you know, in the mainstream, but were being brought into that mass movement. Uh-huh. So how did they become parts of reimagining themselves? Because they were being changed. When you join a movement, the idea takes seed within you and you just become transformed yourself. No longer Guru or Malti or Ram or Kamla.
Context, or there's the characters of the book.
Characters, yeah, of the book. But you become someone who is part of a movement, mm-hmm. that is a noble movement to free your country. So you are reimagining yourself. You are reimagining at the same time, you're changing equations, social equations. It doesn't matter whether you are a Brahmin or a Kshatriya or a Dalit, or everybody is joining that movement. You are united in that. So that's the other very strong message that comes through. And then the third is that you are reimagining your country. What should it be? So the characters here are not only taking part in various freedom protests or activities and writing and, you know, Young India Journal of Mahatma Gandhi, Simon Commission protests, or and they are lathi charged. So, you know, so all of that is there. The drama of, and the feeling that we are heroes, you know, we are martyrs. That feeling is certainly there. But also it's about, where do we want to take the country? What will be a free India look like? Mm. So there is this constitution making, There is this chapter on how the Constitution of India was made and how one of the characters is involved in that. Similarly, when partition happens, what does the character do to help resettlement of refugees? So, you know, these are the kind of issues that are tackled. So you fast forward to where we are now. And so the young people of today will also and are experiencing them, whether they are self-aware or not about it. I want to kind of make them self-aware that you are as much a heroes, as much a part of making that, you know, taking India to that destiny of the 100, India at 100, becoming not only free from poverty, free from, conflict and angst, because this is a youth-rich country, but also that they are integral to it. Mm-hmm. Without them, this will not happen. Yeah. Unless they make that, unless they are self-aware, they reimagine themselves, they keep on contributing in their own might. Because these characters were not Mahatma Gandhi, or they were not...
the regular Indians.
They were regular Indians. So each one, but without them, the success would not, the Mahatma Gandhis would not have succeeded.
Yeah, I think in our history books, we often only cover the winners, right?
So exactly.
So the stories of common people going through the movements that basically shaped the country are largely absolutely missing.
Yes.
Not just in our everyday discourse, mm-hmm, but also in our literature.
Yes.
So it's nice that you've try to cover that, even though it's through the stories of your parents, you've tried to extrapolate that into several other people's stories, because I'm sure everyone who's watching this or listening to this has a grandfather or a great-grandmother who's been through this, who has memories of that time, but is not given the time or place or the platform to express that, because it's never considered too important. Because if you think about it, like I remember in school reading about the independence struggle and being all patriotic and nationalistic. And then several years passed and that cord was severed. And sometimes when an intellectual conversation, someone talks about the independence, it looks like such a foreign event, as if it happened to someone else. But it's because, I guess it's also a testament to the fact that how quickly we've grown, that perhaps some of us take it for granted.
That's true. That's true. Absolutely. But I just want to refer to, you said that this is my parents' story. I just want to slightly, nuance that.
Mm-hmm.
It is inspired by them, but it is very much a fiction. You know, it's a novel.
Right, of course.
And I think when we were chatting earlier, you asked me why I didn't do a biography and why this mode. Because, you know, I wanted it to be an act of creation, you know, because that's my literary seeking, rather than just about capturing what happened in history or what happened as a family saga.
Mm-hmm.
So it's much more than just family saga. I wanted it to be a creative project. And that's why I also wanted it to be touching and moving people more directly, both in terms of the characters in this, and it's a vast cast of characters, as you
yes,
have read,
I have,
and I've seen, and also the setting, you know, epic setting.
Mm-hmm.
And I wanted to, at the personal level, I have this, as I think most of us have, this curiosity about what is love. How does it pan out? So it's one of the, as somebody said to me, this is a love story on a grand scale. Of a kind which has not been done for a long time. So it's also an epic love story. And so I wanted to do that, that love story. Again, inspired, of course, by my parents' story, but beyond that. And the other theme which I was very keen to explore, bringing the world that I inhabited in my last role as leading this the first global organization for gender equality and women's empowerment, I wanted to bring that world into this novel. And it really mixed so well, because my mother's story of Beti Bachao, Beti Padhao, her father being so ahead of his times in refusing to recognize that a girl has to be married away at 10 or 11, or that she doesn't deserve education. And he's really going to the extent of sending them to an orphanage school when their mother dies. So that coincided with my passionate advocacy on women's empowerment. And also this whole question of, you know, we have unfortunately distorted the original conception that we have, and that, you know, women and girls are gods, goddesses, right? Yatra naryastu pujyante ramante tatra devata. That is the belief that we have, and yet we treat them as second class citizens, and as I say in my book, the fifth caste. And so that, to change that perception and to show how as far back as then, this was already starting to be a movement with Maharshi Karve and other social reformers, and how people actually translated those on the ground, such as Baba, the character in the play, who's the father of Malti and Kamla. So this is so this mission of women's equality and also women's empowerment is something that I wanted to bring. And then the overall theme is, again, universal for both men and women, boys and girls, that, you know, if you have that that's something special within you, you will be able to make miracles. You know, if you have faith, you dare, you can attain the impossible. So that's what the title of my book is derived from, Swallowing the Sun. And this is derived from Muktabai, a 13th century saint. I don't know whether you've heard about Sant Gnaneshwar.
Sant Gnaneshwar, no. I have not.
Okay. So, Sant Gnaneshwar is one of the Varkari saints of Maharashtra. Very well known.
Okay. Mm.
And in fact, there was a Bollywood movie many years ago, way before you were born, perhaps.
I was born in 97. Did I miss it?
Huh?
I was born in 97. Did I miss it?
Yes, slightly. Okay. And even if it was there, you... So, but you, everybody knows about Sant Gnaneshwar, but very few know about Sant Muktabai. So that's also the expression, using her abhang to inspire everyone, was one of my purposes. Because she says, Mungi Udali Akashi, Tine Gilde Suryashi, Thor Navla Vazhala, Vans Putra Prasavala, Vinchu Pata Lasi Zai, Shesh Matha Bandi Pai, Mashi Vyali, Ghar Zali, Dekhuni Mukta Bai Hasli. So the ant flies into the sky. She swallows the sun. Another miracle. a barren woman gives birth to a son. The scorpion burrows down to the nether realms. And the snake king, Shesha, bows his head at his feet. The housefly gives birth to a hawk. Muktabai sees, Muktabai laughs. So if you have faith, if you dare, these miracles happen and can happen.
What a great poem.
Yes. So that's what inspired me to inspire my characters. The women characters, you see, each one of them in their own circumstance, they are breaking boundaries.
Mm-hmm.
Whether it ends in triumph or tragedy, but they are impelled to be someone different from what their circumstances bound them down to.
What do you think about the idea
of... And the men characters too are very extraordinary.
What do you think about the idea of Stri Dharma? Because one of the passages that I wrote down was where the daughter's Malti, and here I have, I actually have it. Let me just... Yeah. Kamala and Malti sometimes felt deprived when they were not given fancy clothes or jewelry meant to kindle vanity. But they were thankful to be spared the drudgery of housework and baby rearing, those trades of the fifth caste, which were looked down upon by men as mere duty. And they loved and admired Baba for daring to set them free, and I for not stopping him, even though, like the ladies in the village assembly, it went against all she knew as Stri Dharma. Now, this is very typical where in many tier 3 and tier 4 cities in India and villages, women are meant to learn housework.
Yeah.
They are meant to learn household chores, to cook, clean, feed the family. There is also Raja Beta syndrome where sort of what happens is, like if you have a sister, she will do the housework, and because you're the Raja Beta, the heir apparent of the family, you're meant to just chill, put your feet up on the table, and everything is done for you, right? To exist in that era around the independence and to not do that, which many men, as you say, consider mere duty, is an act of rebellion, completely. How does that tie to what her mother constitutes as Stri Dharma?
Mm-hmm.
And perhaps, what do you think of it now in as we sit in the last month of 2023?
So, that is fundamental to equality. What you have described as gendered roles, you know, that women have to do certain things, girls have to do certain things, boys have to do certain. So I explore that in much detail, with much fun, with tragedy, all of that woven in the novel. So I would encourage people to explore this theme in the novel. Whether it is Malti going to school and having in a school of 60 boys, there are two girls. How she, in the novel begins with a dangal, a fight, a mm-hmm. wrestling match between her and a much bigger classmate, Bhika, who's challenging her and asking her not to cross into the, from the, you know, Lakshman Rekha, how did you cross into our side of the class? So it begins with that. And that struggle is throughout. And yes, it is in a, ahead of its times, but it is also in keeping with the story of every social reform or every change in the way women have progressed from this kind of a very, you know, very bracketed kind of existence where they are limited to be housewives or, as I've said in this, Gangubais, you know, making bhakris and baby rearing. From that to being educated, and as Baba says in the book, being Saraswatis themselves, incarnations of Saraswatis roaming the world, and being Parakrami, you know, going out there and becoming a lawyer, becoming a professor, all of that. So I show that whole spanning of the thought process and how people actually move in the real world to that liberation and equality. Because, you know, I always quote Simone de Beauvoir.
Oh.
Yes. Because she said, no, that women are not born, but become women. So it's how you are conditioned to believe. You can only be this, you can't believe that. And I think we have reached, thankfully, in 2023, a world where I would say a big leap has been made in the thinking of role play. But we really, as you said, in villages, in small towns, you know, we still have to fight this. And even in big cities, even in metros, even in educated families, we have to fight the stereotyping of women's gender roles, gendered roles. And even when you are becoming a lawyer or, you know, you are asked questions about, oh, how will you manage work-life balance? Because men are never asked that question. So all of those, so this is also a way to look back and see where we were then, how things have changed. Even then, how things changed. But how things have changed now and how they should be changing all the time. Because, you know, as you said, when you look back into through the lens of this novel, you will find that so many things have changed, but so many things remain the same. And we need to change that.
Let me play devil's advocate and paint a different picture, because I think that'll be interesting. There's a big movement online, men's movement online, which a lot of women seem to support, where they talk about that there is a merit to following your biological realities, where women are best suited to birth offspring and care for those offspring, and men are best suited to be in provider roles, where they should go out and hunt for food and provide for the family. And this is a natural harmony that must not be disturbed. This is something that if you comply with it, you will have a healthy life and a good family. Now, this movement is resurging because of critics of the kind of feminism that has emerged in the West. Many think that it's spiraled out of control. What would you say to that? Like, I'm sure there is some merit to following roles. Because if we completely reverse roles, 100%, we run the risk of basically having a world where no one knows what to do.
I think what you're describing as a resurgence is a backlash against the changes that have happened, thanks to whether you call it feminist movement, or in India we would call it, I would call it the Nari Shakti, you know, project. This is a kind of backlash. And this is patriarchy hitting back or trying to reclaim space that they are losing, and the logic that they are, the argument that they are losing, the narrative that they are losing.
But what is the
patriarchy? And also the reality that is changing. Okay. Yeah. So I don't think that, yes, it is true that biologically only women can give birth. And therefore, and their nurturing of the baby, breastfeeding, all of that, yes, it is recommended and they should be doing that. But increasingly, this concept of gender equality and women's empowerment encompasses many things. And I just want to also use your forum to talk about it. So there is this goal, Sustainable Development Goal 5, which talks about different rights that women must be guaranteed. And one of them, of course, there's the economic rights, that they have equal rights to work, to access finance, to own property, control over resources, you know, economic autonomy and independence, so that they are not subservient to anyone or dependent on anyone. So this autonomy, economic autonomy is very important. Freedom from violence and harassment, and also very much child marriage, harmful practices like child marriage. So that the laws must treat them equally. And then there is the equal participation in political and economic life as leaders. Voice participation and leadership in economic and political life. So we have the we have just had the reservation, women's reservation bill to equalize the playing field. You know, we are not doing them a favor in that sense. We are trying to equalize the playing field, because women have been kept down, because especially because of this perception that their place is in the home and not in the world. Right? I would say women's place is every place.
Sure.
So that, and then there is something that I personally have worked to include in this goal. By the way, I was very much involved in having this goal, SDG 5, included in the Agenda 2030 for Sustainable Development. And I'm very grateful that, you know, God gave me that opportunity. So there is one target within that goal, which is about valuing, redistributing and provisioning of domestic and unpaid care work of women. Think about it. Exactly your question.
I think those are all...
So when you say care work, whether it is childcare, whether it is caring for elderly, because these are the two important care work responsibilities in families. And whether it is domestic work, cooking, cleaning, all of that. Yes, traditionally, this has fallen on women. And in India, you know, the men traditionally have been sharing only 1/10 of these burdens. But increasingly, and I've seen young people, especially in metro cities, increasingly young fathers are participating in child care. They are sharing in the burden in domestic work, cooking, and you know, and as a matter of pleasure and something that you share and where your love grows, you know. So I think these are also more harmonious relationships, more equal relationships, are more pleasurable relationships. And some of that I've tried to capture in the book as well. You know, that when you have unequal relationships, when you are putting one person down and restricting her spirit, then you are, it's not a happy relationship.
But we've also seen many women and men follow traditional paths, but ultimately decide, or follow unconventional paths, ultimately decide that they prefer to, for example, some men prefer to just, some men wanted to be stay-at-home dads, they tried it, it didn't work out, so they decided to just do the conventional thing and have their wife take care of the children. Vice versa, some women tried, for example, to have a full-time job, but then they decided maybe it's not for me, and then they went back to taking care of the family and they were happy with it. Now, you said it is because the patriarchy is reacting to it. I see this word thrown around a lot, and I think I sort of understand the definition of feminism, because I've spoken to many and I've read about it online, but it seems to me that the word patriarchy is often not defined well. So what do you mean when you say that? Like
Pitrusatta in Hindi. But patriarchy means that structurally society is structured in such a way that women and girls are undervalued, devalued, and seen as inferior beings, and the power is with men and boys. You were talking about the Raja Beta syndrome, for example. So, and also the head of family is the concept of the head of family by itself.
Karta. Huh? The Hindu so, Karta system.
So that is the patriarch of the family, right?
Yeah.
So he defines the rules of the game within the family, right? And the power relationships. So that is patriarchy reflected in different fields, whether it's in politics, whether it is in economics, ownership of property, I defined to you, access to resources, financial independence, access to financial resources, all of that. Now, coming back to your question about how do relationships today, you know, of course, and I'm no way disrespecting or undervaluing or devaluing when women choose to be housewives and take care of their children, either throughout their life cycle or at certain points of their life cycle. This is perfectly understandable, and they have a right, provided they have options.
They should not be
forced into it.
I see.
So I think that is that's absolutely understandable. And these are life choices you make. But you must have that choice and not be forced. You see, we have today in India, it's also if you look at the issue of tapping woman power for the economy. And, you know, Prime Minister Modi has articulated this idea of women-led development. So unless women participate equally in the workforce, in entrepreneurship, in science and technology, we are not tapping into this half the resource of half the country. So, you know, you need them to be in all of these fields. In politics, how can you have a democracy when half of your population is left out of the voice participation and leadership in political spaces and governance? So this is also about the society that you want, the economy that you want and you aspire to, the country that you want, and also the culture.
Yeah, I will not say something. When I was in Spain, I noticed a disproportionate amount of women working everywhere, from desk jobs to even being bus conductors, and a lot of the attendants at restaurants I interacted with were women. That's not very typical in India. In the services industry, even in hotels, you would still see that people manning the receptions, there's lots more men than women. So I don't think you're right, we haven't really deployed females in the Indian workforce as much as we should, considering that their skills are underutilized.
It is. And they are dropping off also because of child-rearing responsibilities, marriage, you know. And then they are trying to come back. So there is this, this pyramid of entry, promotion, and the leaking pipeline. You drop off, and then re-entry is a challenge.
And it's very hard when you re-enter, right?
Exactly.
Because you have to justify that error.
So there is that issue, definitely. But having said that, I'm very optimistic and I'm very proud of all the women who are breaking glass ceilings and glass walls. You know, we have, I think, the highest number of pilots, women pilots in the world, and percentage-wise also. And we have women scientists, and look at ISRO and the space program, Chandrayaan included. Women leaders were very much involved in that. And we have 43% of women in STEM, which is a very high percentage compared to the world. But the problem is, they graduate, but not everyone moves into research institutions or into practicing what they have learned. So education to the occupational, you know, trajectory is often blocked or dysfunctional. So we have to make that, you know, change happen. Today we have women entrepreneurs galore, and the self-help groups are you know, we have millions of self-help women self-help groups which are pioneering their way into being in every sector, from micro to SMEs, most of our SMEs. But we also need more and more women to be in the macro enterprise sector, and many of them are, and we have so many great examples of that. You know, Sangeeta Reddy in Apollo Hospitals. You have also so many others who are in biotech, and Kiran Shaw Mazumdar in biotech. So we, and also these you know, the startups,
tons of women there, yeah.
Tons of women there. And certainly in traditionally also, in fact, you mentioned about you know, we were earlier talking about software and IT and tech 4.0. Women have been predominant in, for example, you remember the remote call centers we used to have.
BPOs.
BPOs. Well, they used to be, some of them used to have as many as 60% women.
Yeah, but
so now they have to also graduate from being in the lower you know, downstream in AI and tech 4.0 to being upstream and, you know, in the higher echelons of science and technology.
But don't you think that sometimes, in the best of our efforts, we can often misconstrue an equality of opportunity for competence? What I mean by that is, some jobs are just better suited to men, and some jobs are just better suited to women, right? Like, for example, all the dangerous jobs, like construction work and all of those things, right? So, at what point does this, you know, this drive to create an absolute equality of opportunity, it gets a flavor of, you know, accommodation?
Interesting question, because, you know, yes, the biological differences between men and women, some of them can be overcome with training. And we have seen it now. You see, we have now opened up the Army, Navy, and Air Force to women, right? And women are performing with equal competence. You saw the movie Tejas?
I have not seen it, no.
You must. And now we have the first woman Navy commander of a ship, you know, battleship. So we are breaking those. As I said, those are glass walls, occupational glass walls, that some are better. You may say they are better suited, but also it's conditioning. You've always thought women should not be fighting. But if women are ready, physically trained, they can as well fight like men. So it's, you know, the definition of feminism, which Gloria Steinem gave, is always with me, and it breaks all the misconceptions about what is feminism and what is equality. And she says, feminist is anyone who believes in the humanity and equality of both men and women. So, short of giving birth to a baby, men can do everything that women do and be in any profession, fashion, cooking. Most of the chefs are, you know, men, which is also not fair. More women should be. But that's happening too, by the way. I'm now seeing many more women chefs.
Yeah.
You know, fashion, design, many of those. So soft skill areas, soft areas, which you mentioned, the cultural areas.
Yeah.
The kind. So there is an immiseration that is happening. That is an intermingling that is happening. And equalizing that is happening, which is very welcome and needed. And I encourage all young people. You know, we have this concept of generation equality.
What?
Yes.
Generation equality?
Huh? Yes. So in UN Women, we did many campaigns. And I think one of them, which was very successful, was He for She campaign.
Okay.
Emma Watson.
Of course.
Yes.
I know the campaign now. Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes. So that was our campaign, UN Women, when I was there. And then we did Unstereotype with companies, with a lot of major Procter & Gamble, Lever, and all these companies, big multinationals. We partnered with them to carry out what is called the Unstereotype campaign, that, you know, to break down the stereotypes you have about women's and men's roles and what they can and their capabilities. This is the important part. What is capability? And then we had campaigns like Planet 50-50 by 2030.
Which is to increase the population of women?
No. That it's the planet is half women and half men, and it should be an equal planet, gender equal planet.
Hmm.
Yes, in every area. So, you know, that kind of aspiration, step it up for gender equality. So we had so many of these campaigns and say no to violence against women, zero tolerance for violence against women. So, you know, there were these many campaigns to advocacy and movement building. We did a march for gender equality, first time, 20,000 women in New York City. So, yeah. So, you know, and then such marches were held all around the world in 2015 when we adopted this agenda for 2030.
Let me ask you a slightly, slightly controversial question, which is, you know, I've obviously seen, so for to set context, just like the feminist movement, there's a new movement online called Men Going Their Own Way, called the MGTOW, right? Where there's a new brand of meninists now coming up, realizing that the new brand of feminism is too harsh on them, on to perhaps, whether we like it or not, the new brand of feminism has been equated with hating men, exclusively hating men. And whether that is something we see in the lowest rungs when we see social media, it's begun to push men away and form their own unions and groups. And, you know, we can debate whether they're the disadvantaged sex or not. That's a separate issue altogether. But you gave me a different definition. You said Gloria Steinem said something else. What would you say to feminists who actively believe that at the core of this philosophy is a hatred for men?
Feminists never believe that. And this is a deliberate misinterpretation. And also sometimes misunderstanding. I grant that. So sometimes it is deliberate misinterpretation. But also I grant that there is, based on the narrative spread by patriarchy and those who, you know, are very orthodox and hold on to this concept of...
I don't think it's spread by patriarchy necessarily.
Because listen, the roles you hold on, you know, you don't want to lose. They think it's about handing over power. I'm going to lose power as a Raja Beta in my family.
Sure.
Or I'm going to lose power as the head of, male head of a family, if I cede it to my wife or my daughter-in-law or whatever. So, and the same happens in the panchayat. In India, we today have 50% reservation in many states, 33% reservation for women as sarpanches and panch, you know, so village councillors and Jila Parishad councillors. So now there is a better balancing of the roles, right? And more empowerment in that sense and sharing of power. Mm-hmm. So it's all about sharing of power. It's not about disempowering men, mm-hmm. number one. It's not about hating men. It is not at all, in fact, about hating men. It's about getting the men to respect and love women in their lives and be friends with women in their lives on an equal basis.
Agreed.
Not as someone who is to be subjugated, to be violated, to be looked down upon, or somehow to be seen as children of a lesser god. That's what it is. And therefore, to say that feminism is against men is absolutely wrong. In fact, emotionally, and in terms, I mean, if you talk to any psychologist today, and I know the young generation believes in good mental health and also in the science of psychology. If you have a belief in gender equality and women's empowerment, when you regard your mother, your sister, your classmates, your colleagues, your peers who are women and girls, your equal, your friend, even your mother, your friend, you yourself are more emotionally whole and fulfilled than you would otherwise be.
Ardha Narishwara,
which yeah. I have explored
that's why,
very
that's
much.
That's why I reference it.
Yes.
Yeah, no, Carl Jung has this concept that you become whole when you... if you're a man, it's your anima. If you're a woman, it's your animus. It's your masculine or feminine part. Granted. All of that is granted. What I was saying specifically is there's a loud minority of women who equate feminism with hating men that has nothing to do with any patriarchal message at all. It is simply a vicious attack against the idea of being a man. Right?
I haven't come across it. And I don't think such a movement exists. It is imagined sometimes by people who want to, as I said, as part of the backlash to an increasing movement to or towards gender equality and women's empowerment. So that is definitely my own sense. Just talking about men and movements, when we were with UN Women, we had Farhan Akhtar.
I know he's the ambassador.
So he has the, he used to be. And he had a movement called Mard.
Mm-hmm.
Sacha Mard kaun hai? Sacha Mard wohi hai jo mahilaon ka ya bachiyon ka
aadar
samman kare aur unko wohi jo darja de jo aap kisi bhi पुरुष को और 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 अपने बेटे को देते हो या भाई को देते हो या किसी भी आदमी को देते हो. So that is the whole concept, the opposite of what you were saying, na ki hating uh-huh. men. This is the polar opposite of that men not hating women, not regarding them below them and giving them respect.
No, I agree with you.
And it has to be mutual.
Yeah.
You know, I'll recall a joke or a real encounter I had with the foreign minister of Russia, Sergei Lavrov. I was attending a reception that was hosted by the Russian ambassador in New York, and I was representing UN Women. So I introduced myself, and I was wearing a sari. So he was very, you know, India and Russia have that special relationship. So when he saw me and I introduced myself, I said, I'm from UN Women. He says, oh my God, soon we are going to need a UN men. So I said, no, but Excellency, our objective is to reach a place and space where neither men nor women will need UN men or UN women. That is the stage where we will be in equilibrium.
What will that equilibrium achieve? Because what will we strive for then if the sexes are 100% completely equal, balanced in every aspect of our lives?
No,
it's, what will that achieve ultimately?
It will achieve harmony, and it will achieve greater happiness, and it will achieve freedom from violence. It will achieve, you know, even conflicts in society, so much are rooted in domestic violence
that
against women.
Yeah.
So, you know, all the baser instincts mm-hmm. get suppressed, not only suppressed, but eliminated when you think in terms of these Ardhanarishwar terms.
Yeah.
It's mutually also fulfilling. Mutually fulfilling relationships.
It's also like the yin and yang symbol. You've got a little bit of the...
Well, yes. Yes. But, you know, yin and yang is seen more as polar opposites, and, you know, never that the twain shall meet. But Ardhanarishwar is a fusion.
Mm-hmm.
So in each of us, in my novel too, in each of us, whether it is Guru or Malti, she has these strengths. And you know, what is typically seen as masculine traits.
Mm-hmm.
She has them, and she displays them at different points. Guru shows the vulnerabilities that women are supposed to show.
Mm-hmm.
And yet, there are times when he's strong and she's vulnerable. So, you know, there are these, there is a melding of these attributes that we see as men and as women. And these are not constant in one gender or person. They change, and they should be able to change.
Mm-hmm.
So in that sense, it's that equilibrium also. And it's never perfect, of course. There will always be ups and downs.
Yeah, I've seen that there are seasons of life where you're very, very extremely masculine, extremely driven, extremely on the forefront of getting things done. And then there are seasons of life when you're very receptive, warm, and nurturing to your own self. And each has its own merit. And I think both women and men go through that. Fair to say. Wow. I never expected to encounter these views. But I guess it really helps to be the UN woman person. Sorry, what was your exact role at UN?
I was Assistant Secretary General.
Yes, but
at the UN, and then I was Deputy Executive Director of UN Women.
Okay.
This was in my second incarnation.
So you were working with a global team at this point to...
I was in New York, basically.
You was in New York, York. And
for 7 years.
The Emma Watson campaign. Were you like directly a part of that?
Yes, yes. Of course.
Yeah. Wow. What is it like? Because I've seen the UN headquarters up and close in New York, because obviously, to be posted in different countries that are not the states, that are not the Supreme West, let's just say. What was it like being an Indian in New York, working on whatever you were working on?
Well, Indians are very strong as professionals in the UN. Very respected, very capable, very hardworking, driven.
Mm-hmm.
And so I was completely at home in that sense, because all of those qualities I strove to demonstrate.
Mm-hmm.
So, and New York is, of course, very multicultural. and very strong and large contingent of Indians there. I think some 1.5 million Indians are in the New York area. So I didn't feel at all. But in any case, as I told you, we adapt. And my adaptation into the UN universe and culture, because UN has its own culture, it's multicultural from all races, all countries, all continents, and different ideologies. So how do you adapt to that? That was very exciting in so many ways. And discovering them, your colleagues, where they come from, not only the place where they come from, but where they come from in terms of their aspiration. You know, where have they come from and where are they now? What are they trying to do? And how can we work with them and bring out their best? So as a leader, then you have to bring out the best of a very multicultural team and multinational team. So that's the excitement of working in the UN and also working on the global public goods agendas.
When we talk about love today, the way I see it in my generation, love is split across multiple social media platforms. Love is split across the people I see in my gym, the people I see in my society, the people I see elsewhere. But it's all split across, and there are an endless list of options. You can swipe right on someone and swipe left on someone and materialize that match and actually meet them, or you can completely ignore them and move on. You've basically got a shopping list of dating options available, right? On the other hand, people are lonelier than they've ever been at the same time. I'm saying this anecdotally, but I also have some studies that could back it up because I've read some.
Absolutely true.
Because all of this excess and all of this availability has caused an alienation from the entire purpose of dating or romance in the first place. So companionship is happening in the most weird way. It's not lasting as it should. People are marrying later. And there is overall, I mean, I can speak for the men certainly. There is actually, it's become so bad in certain ways. There is actually a community of males online called incels, which is involuntarily celibate, because they've been so flat out rejected by women, and because they are so under socialized, because they never go out and they're just always online, and they have no confidence, that they've decided that they're going to remain celibate forever. This is sadly what we are like. This is the state of love and dating in the country right now.
Well, my novel, Swallowing the Sun, is really about rekindling. It's really about rekindling that love. That, as you said, is sapping out of our society. And see, what is love? It is a mystery that needs to be unveiled. It needs to be experienced in different ways. And I'm trying to show in this novel that in the 1920s, young people who were from traditional families, but thrown into Western education, you know, in Elphinstone College, Bombay, in the heart of the freedom movement. And there is a certain romance about, you know, being around a political social ferment. And then in that context, discovering themselves and discovering love and discovering what is love. So I encourage, and there is so much poetry and theater, because in my characters, they act in a play as the hero and the heroine. And then they come together also because of that. But even before that, they were friends. But they graduate from being friends to, because they come to, you know, they meet. It's a kind of play date. You know, they're meeting every day for some 30 days and enacting scenes between, sometimes romantic scenes between themselves. And then that brings them closer. But also their shared love of nationalism, you know, they're wanting to contribute to the freedom movement. That brings them, that's another thread of love. Then there is love of poetry, I mentioned, mm-hmm. of drama. And he also takes her to, for the first time, to see Bal Gandharva, you know, Marathi theater, mm-hmm. Musical theater, and to experience it together. So, you know, love is born in so many different ways and it's nurtured in so many different ways. So that's what I show. And I want exactly those kind of people, but also those who are already lovers, who have found love, who are going through the ups and downs of love, to experience what it was like those days. Also, the love letters. Today, you write very brief WhatsApp messages, perhaps. They are also telegraphic. And maybe you write an email sometimes. But I think letters are more or less not anymore, are extinct, right?
People do write thank you notes and they write a long thing if they're grateful. And people usually treasure those like they did.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly. But I wanted to also revive the idea of letter writing because I have some 148 love letters and, you know, some of them are in the original, almost 90 years ago, written 90 years ago, 148 of them, which I culled, from which I culled some of this, the romance from. And that too, letters, because they connect you when you have a long distance relationship.
Yeah.
In particular, if you are in the same city, also sometimes, you know, you may be able to connect better, get to know the other person better, much better, even when you talk to that person.
Yeah, because when you do a video call, you're sort of
wired kind of tongue-tied. And also tongue-tied, right?
Yeah, I think sometimes, when you sit down to write, you're really thinking about each word because it's going to be with them forever.
Exactly.
So you say things you would never say on a phone call.
Voila. That's true. And that's why, and Guru's letters, if you've read them, they are about, as he says, please write to me. Please write to me anything. And most of all, about yourself. Tell me about yourself. What you are doing, what you are thinking. Because what matters to me most is that you are the fountainhead of my inspiration. So write to me. And then he talks about, waiting for your letters. I go to the post box 3 times a day and I come back empty-handed and I'm morose. You know, so there is that waiting for that. So the letter assumes a human form. And even for Malathi, his letters become a kind of, you know, a second self. He's talking to her even when she's walking. And then she starts talking to herself, you know, as replying to his letters, talking to herself. So it becomes a kind of alter ego, a second self.
I do
scolding her, you know, cajoling her, all kinds of sentiments.
I do notice that the kind of love that
and the
described,
poetry. Yeah. I don't know whether you...
I've skimmed through the poetry, poetry.
Which he then, you know, his ode to her where he proposes to her and then says, you are my goddess. You know, he elevates her to a pedestal of being a goddess and then pledges what he's going to do in that role of a devotee.
Wow.
Yes.
It is so, that reality is so far removed from
these
times.
But it need not be. And it is a mutual adoration as you do. Because then that is the height of respect, right?
Yeah. No,
it's the height of respect.
This love is very innocent and pure. What usually happens nowadays is all punctuated by social media and distractions.
Absolutely. But this is what I want to just
please
share
ahead
with you. You know, he begins by saying that Madhumalti, you are the goddess installed in my temple's sanctum sanctorum to the exhilarating heartbeats of celestial drums, my fevered chanting and joyous limpid songs. You accept me as your devotee and I pledge my whole life to you. My dreams, dreamt and undreamt, for you to see and turn into miracles. So, you know, this is that sentiment that even your quest for greatness is enabled by someone who is beside you and in front of you and someone who reciprocates that benediction, you know. So it's a divination. And then it ends with, O Madhumalti, let the beguiling veil of Maya once and for all be pierced and fall. Between the manifest and the truth, between the striving and the attainment, between the worshipper and the worshipped, between me and you.
Very nice. So
this is the acme of love. But of course, once you move deeper into a relationship, you will have ups and downs. You will have successes and failures. But, you know, to all those bereft of love or seeking love or not or feeling indifferent about it, I would say go out there and discover. And don't, and take the risk.
Yeah, no, this poem is wonderful, by the way. But you know what, like, Just to give you context, like if the guys are watching this, they're going to say this guy's a simp. You know what a simp is?
Simpleton?
No, a simp is someone who just basically falls head over heels for a girl and puts her on a pedestal. It's not cool anymore to do that. Like that's what they think. So this is very interesting that this is a brand of love that is innocent of all of those things.
So let me just say that this is a stage.
Mm-hmm.
In your what used to be called courtship then and is called dating now.
Oh, okay. Did you actually use the word courtship?
Yes, because these characters in my Guru and Malti, they have a 7-year courtship, right?
Yeah, of just talking.
Huh?
Of just talking and like just holding hands.
Absolutely, and poetry and letter writing and but what I'm saying is it's a stage and a phase. Of course, you move from that into other phases. You have quarrels, you have breakdowns, you have breakups, as it happens here.
Yeah, I've also written poems for
the
several
highs
women.
And highs and lows. Hmm?
Yeah. No, it's just for me, it's very fascinating to compare it with modern dating is like.
I'm also equally edified and fascinated listening to you and giving me the young people's perspective. But absolutely, I feel this novel is for you to rediscover the value of love and what is love. And to think for yourself what is love.
Yeah, I think...
Rethink for yourself.
That's the right word, rethink, because... I can speak this for a big chunk of my generation. Sadly, our idea of love has been very punctured by an overstimulation through social media and excessive options so that you don't let love blossom the way it's supposed to blossom. Monogamy as a concept is a dream that may or may not happen because there's so many options. So like the butterflies in your stomach can't even happen because you're distracted, you're not spending enough time. The innocence with which these characters fall in love and the time they let the love blossom is a rarity in today's times, is what I've seen. But perhaps that is what is needed because there should be a correction and people should go to what makes them happy from the inside.
Absolutely, absolutely. And also, you need a purpose larger than just that relationship to bind it together as well.
Because if they're just on the relationship, then it's going to get toxic, right?
Yes, yes. So you need all of that, you know, that you want to reimagine yourself, you want to reimagine the world around you, the country around you, achieve things together, you know, set goals together. That's the excitement.
What would you say?
Of co-creating, of inhabiting different new spaces.
What would you say is a message to young Indians watching this? I have an audience from anywhere from the ages of 13 to 65, mostly in the 13 to 34 bracket. Mm. The 40 bracket is my largest audience. Mm. So what would you want to say to them as someone who's had the career that you've had, has written the book that you've written, has had the life that you've had?
Yes. Well, I have already said what I wanted to say about believing in the equality of men and women. I've also said much about believing in love and the power of potential, power of love. To transform your lives and to give you true happiness. I would also say enrich your life with poetry and reading and novels.
Love novels.
Including love novels, but I would
say... I said I love novels.
Yeah. And it's about time travel. Mm-hmm. You know, you're traveling back in time to a magical world, which you half recognize, but half you've forgotten or you don't even know.
Mm-hmm.
So rediscover that. And I would say always keep time traveling because it keeps you grounded also in terms of how far we have come.
Keeps you happy also.
Keeps happy. And also sets your compass for the future. Mm-hmm. And I would also say to young viewers, but all viewers, but young viewers in particular, that you are the nucleus in the atom, in the molecule of nation building.
Mm-hmm.
And don't think that you have to be... a leader, a political leader, or a tycoon, corporate tycoon, or to make a contribution in remaking or in the making of a new India and a new Indian. Because all the time, you know, we are evolving, we are remaking ourselves and the society around us to make it more humane, to make it more... of course, prosperous, because there is in India, that is a very important goal that we have set. We want to be a developed country by 2047, by the time we are 100 years away from our independence, where this book almost ends after that, 1950. So get engaged in that grand project of meeting our, you know, the second tryst with destiny. You know, the first was 1947. Mm-hmm. Now it's going to be 2047. So you are very much a part of this grand project, and gear up for it and be self-aware about who you are in this, not only in your family, but in your community, in the country and the world, because I bring a lot of the world into this, although it is based in India, but there are so many ideas and people from the world that I bring into this book. So it's also about that.
Before we end, because we talked about books and reading, and we also off camera discussed Kamala Markandeya, and you had an expression which meant that you recognized that book.
Yes, of course.
This is a difficult question because it's very hard to sort of give a book recommendation list on from the top of your head.
Mm.
But maybe you could perhaps describe books you're reading right now, or five books that you would recommend people read, and you can take your time with it. Whatever is most easy to do. Because I know if someone asked me five books to recommend, I'd probably go blank because there are so many.
Well, I'm a great fan of among the Indian writers in English. I've very much been influenced by R.K. Narayan, by Raja Rao, and definitely Salman Rushdie and his magical realism is another world. But of course, we have grown up, in terms of English writing, and of course, Jhumpa Lahiri and others have made great strides in terms of recognition and their appeal to the new Indian, because she has this perspective of Indians living abroad.
I love her stories based in Cambridge.
Yes, I've lived there myself. So there are many of these. And then, of course, the classic British and American writers I would always recommend going back to from time to time, again, in terms of time travel, but also ideas travel. And Charles Dickens and the Bronte sisters, and there are so many now being made into films, so it's easy to relate. And the poetry, I would really recommend people going back into poetry, T.S. Eliot, Yeats, and my all-time favorite is Rabindranath Tagore. Although I'm not fortunate enough to read it in the original Bengali, but in English. And I think Hindi, very good Hindi translations are also available. Yes, you've got me there with...
That's why I said this is one of those things where it's very difficult to say it from the top of your head. But I think this is a pretty...
B.S. Naipaul, many of those. E.M. Forster is one of my... favorite writers also who has influenced me. Somerset Maugham.
Okay.
So these are from an earlier time. And then, of course, we have so many Indian writers in English today. Mm-hmm. So I would say support them, read them, because they have really made a very big impact in the English-speaking world.
And hopefully and India, you as well.
I hope so. And India is becoming, if not it is already, the largest English-speaking country in the world.
Really?
Yes.
All right, that makes sense because we have a big population. So if all of us speak English, eventually we can...
But even already, we are the largest English-speaking country.
Even more than the USA?
Well, USA... There now the Latin population there, with the Latin population there,
I see. Yeah.
Quite a few don't speak English as much.
That is
as
true.
Yes, yeah, yeah, as yeah, much yeah. as Spanish. You have been to Spain, but if you go to the US now, you know, Spanish has just taken over quite a lot.
Yeah.
No, but I'm saying that, you know, more and more Indians are now. So that's why we are becoming also our writing. Is becoming more impactful in the English-speaking world.
I agree. Mm. Yeah. Awesome. Well, I have to say, very honestly, I came to this conversation having a fair idea of what I was going to ask and perhaps a visualization of how this was going to go. But it wasn't the easiest because some of the things you said today made me reevaluate things I've thought for several years. Made me go to corners of my mind I haven't gone into in a while and made me rethink a lot of things. So thank you for that. It's very easy to do something that...
Thank you for being open on that.
Yeah, I mean, no, I just had to be honest about that because it's very hard to change your mind in real time, but some of the things you said today were very compelling. Around women's issues and love particularly. I haven't seen ideas around love at all like this. My idea of love is very, very cemented in this, in the times that I live in. So thank you for that. And thank you for being so articulate about so many things, because I think we discussed a bunch of things today, everything from your time in the IFS, UN, diplomacy, all the way to the multiple facets of your book and India itself. And yeah, thank you for your time. Thank you for getting us into your lovely home. And where can people find the book if they want to get the book?
Yes. Please go and get the book at Amazon. You can pre-order now. Mm-hmm. And it should be available in all the bookshops as from 5th of January.
Amazing. Amazing. Thank you so much. It was a pleasure talking to you.
Pleasure talking to you too. And discovering... in turn, I was enlightened about how you young people feel about so many things that my book has talked about. And it makes me feel convinced that this book is as contemporary as it is a journey in time travel.
Mm-hmm. Thank you so much.
Thank you.